Usually, I mean, a revenge story is a straight line, right? Someone wrongs you, you hunt them down and you get even.
Right, it's supposed to be clean,
Sure.
very linear.
Exactly. Makes sense. But what if tracking down a simple murderer for a childhood vendetta accidentally leads you into a basement where a mechanical spider is trying to literally stop time itself?
Yeah, that definitely shatters the linear path completely.
It really does. Today, we are taking a deep dive into a deeply personal quest for vengeance that spirals so wildly out of control. It's mind-bending. We're taking a stack of source documents detailing the harrowing ordeals of a party of adventurers. And, well, for you listening, we're going to see just how deep this rabbit hole goes.
It is the absolute definition of narrative escalation. I mean, you start looking for a mundane killer, and before you know it, you are peeling back the hidden, terrifying layers of the world itself.
So true. We are pulling a single thread here, a search for a man with a yellow glass eye, and watching it unravel into a city-shattering battle against a mythical terror. So let's just jump right into the Shipyards District on Weaver Street in Holland.
Perfect starting point.
Our lens for this part of the journey is Kiltak. He's a warrior who has basically spent his entire life looking for the one-eyed man who murdered his parents.
Oh.
And he gets a tip that a local prosthetist named Vorman specializes in custom glass eyes.
Right, which makes logical sense for a lead.
Yeah, so Kiltak and his party head to Vorman's shop. But, I mean, have you ever walked into a business that was supposedly open, but the vibe was just instantly overwhelmingly wrong?
Oh, absolutely. And that is precisely the atmosphere the sources describe here. This is, supposed to be a medical facility,
Right.
a place of healing and precision.
Right.
But the entrance is completely cluttered. One of the main double doors is physically jammed shut by a massive pile of uncollected mail.
That's never a good sign.
No, it's not. And inside, the waiting room is choked with delivery boxes. It does not look like a functioning clinic that welcomes patients.
It looks like a front,
Right.
right? Okay, let's unpack this. As they start poking around these boxes and workbenches, they do find high-end prosthetics. We aren't just talking wooden peg legs. They find intricate skeletal ironwork hands.
Which, makes sense for a prosthetist.
It does. But then they find letters on a desk that hint at something much larger. The letters mention admiralty operations happening on an island called Hild, and they repeatedly reference a mysterious new concept called Numa.
That word pneuma is critical to understanding everything that follows. In our ancient Greek, it means breath or spirit. But in the context of these documents, it signifies a specific, highly potent application of magic.
Like giving life to things.
Exactly. It is a massive clue about what Vorman is actually funding with his medical practice.
But Kiltak, I mean, he isn't there for geopolitics or magical theory. He's there for revenge. And he finds his smoking gun right on the
The
desk.
package.
Yes. A partially packaged box addressed to Grenvolder's Antiques at 249 Market Street in the neighboring city of Braddock. And inside the box is a yellow glass eye with a slit pupil, exactly like a cat's eye. Kiltak claims it instantly.
He has his next destination. He could just leave right then.
But they don't, because the ground floor of this shop keeps getting weirder. They find workbenches covered in, like, fist-sized mechanical spiders that you wind up with a key. And worse, they find dozens of female mannequins.
And these are not standard display dummies for fitting clothes or prosthetics.
No, they are super creepy.
The party realizes these mannequins have winding keys set into the back of their heads and intricate camshafts built directly into their metallic spines.
It's deeply unsettling. Imagine a sinister Geppetto's workshop, but like industrial. Some of these mannequins are rigged to physically pluck harps. Some are sitting at desks, writing out scrolls with perfectly neat, repetitive handwriting.
Just endless repetition.
Yeah, and some are just programmed to wave and bow to an empty room. The joints are rickety, the movements are jerky, and I have to ask, why would a supposedly legitimate doctor be outfitting wooden dummies with mechanical spines and building wind-up spiders? It makes zero medical sense.
It doesn't make medical sense, but it makes perfect industrial sense. Vorman is using the veneer of a medical craftsman to hide a massive automated manufacturing operation.
Wait, really? Like a factory?
Yes. The real tell is the reading material the party finds scattered around the workshop. They don't just find medical texts. They find a book called Design of a New Astronomical Clock by a Manfred Unger and another simply titled Programmable Looms.
Programmable looms. I mean, in our history, the Jacquard loom was basically the first computer. It used punch cards to automate weaving. Are you saying Vorman is trying to invent robotics?
Exactly. He is making a terrifying conceptual leap here. He is moving from biology helping injured humans to automated machinery.
Oh.
He isn't making prosthetics for people anymore. He is making people out of prosthetics. Mm-hmm. He is trying to build a tireless automated workforce. And the scary part is, he's actually succeeding.
The party figures that out pretty quickly when they decide to investigate the lower levels of the shop. They head down into the first basement, and the horror movie elements really kick into high gear.
It gets so dark so fast.
They are immediately ambushed in the dark by those mechanical spiders, except these aren't fist-sized anymore. They're the size of large, mastiff dogs.
And amidst that chaos, they meet a very unexpected ally. An actual massive, mastiff dog comes padding down the stairs, sniffing through the dark like a bloodhound.
Right, but it's not a dog.
No, it physically morphs, shifting its anatomy until it stands up as a 7'3" man with a white streaked mane of hair.
Victor Ashbourne. He's a druid who has been tracking a man named Barnaby for years because Barnaby slaughtered Victor's entire clan.
It's yeah.
Fascinating how the sources weave these parallel revenge plots together, you know?
Well, it really is. Two men driven by vengeance meeting in a basement full of robot spiders.
Totally. So Victor joins up with Kiltak's party. And they push deeper into the second basement. And things go from creepy to genuinely lethal. They find wide streaks of dried blood dragged across the stone floor, leading to two dead bodies.
And the identities of the dead are important here. One of them is a rune priest from the Caliphate. Victor examines the bodies and determines they weren't cut or stabbed. They were killed by massive blunt force trauma.
Meaning whatever is down there is incredibly strong. Now, here is where the party does something incredibly clever. They find some of those pneuma spell scrolls on the bodies.
Ah, yes. The breath or spirit magic.
Right. So they cast it on a nearby, unpowered mannequin. The magic floods the machinery, animating the dummy, giving it a semblance of breath and motion. They basically reprogram it on the fly.
It's brilliant.
They tell it to walk down to the next level, check if there's a bloodied mannequin down there, and come back. They instruct it, like, thumbs up for yes, thumbs down for no.
It is a brilliantly practical use of magic for reconnaissance. They are literally turning the enemy's automated workforce against it.
Right. So imagine you are standing in this pitch black, blood-stained basement, just waiting. 5 minutes later, the jerky wooden mannequin comes clattering back up the stairs. It raises its hand. Thumbs up.
Yes, there's a bloodied mannequin downstairs.
And then the party asks if the bloodied mannequin is friendly. The animated dummy stares at them and slowly rotates its hand to give them a literal thumbs down.
It provides a moment of dark comedy, certainly, but it also establishes the sheer scale of the danger below. The automation has become actively hostile.
So they sneak down to the third basement, and it's a massive 75-foot-long room. It's a full-blown assembly line. 20 mannequins are standing at workstations, actively building more automatons, while those dog-sized mechanical spiders are digging a tunnel and dumping the rubble.
Just a tireless, terrifying factory.
But they manage to bypass this industrial nightmare and descend to the fourth and final basement. And this is where reality just fractures.
This is the apocalyptic escalation I was talking about.
They find the bloodied mannequin. Her name is Hester, but she isn't just standing guard. She is standing at a stone altar, actively conducting a ritual. And looming behind her is Kronos.
Kratos?
Yeah. Kronos is a giant astronomical clock, intricately built into the shape of a massive spider god. Hester is praying to this machine, conducting a ritual that the sources literally designate as end time.
We need to be very clear about the stakes here, because the texts are explicit. Kronos is not a weapon of war or a guardian. It is a machine designed purely and simply to unravel the fabric of the universe.
And this is where my mind just short circuits. Think about the scale of that jump.
It's massive.
So what does this all mean? How does a party looking for a simple murderer following a mail delivery clue about a glass eye accidentally stumble into a room where a clockwork spider is trying to halt time itself? It's absurd. It's like walking into your local hardware store to buy a wrench and finding a nuclear launch sequence counting down in a plumbing aisle.
That is a great analogy. It is deeply jarring, but it reveals the fundamental nature of the reality these characters inhabit. It underscores how fragile their world is, with apocalyptic threats hidden beneath the floorboards of a mundane city street.
Right, just totally hidden.
But if we look closely at how this fight operates, we see the true conceptual terror of Vorman's work. The pneuma magic giving breath to the inanimate is being used to bridge the gap between arcane spell casting and mechanical engineering.
So it's not just like a wizard casting a fireball in a tower. It's the industrialization of magic.
Exactly. It is mass-produced, programmed sorcery. And during the combat, Kronos uses abilities that reflect this terrifying precision. It attacks Kiltak with an effect described as constant space-time velocity.
Oh, man.
It isn't just hitting him, it is manipulating the localized flow of time, warping gravity, so Kiltak is thrown randomly across the room at blinding speeds.
That's terrifying.
Meanwhile, Kronos manipulates the temporal flow around Hester, granting her haste, accelerating her movements to a blur. And all the while, those smaller robotic spiders are crawling over the giant clock god, frantically replacing gears and repairing its chassis mid-fight.
But the party actually manages to overwhelm it.
Yeah.
They disrupt the gears, sever the magical Pneuma tethers, and destroy Kronos and Hester, stopping the end-time ritual just seconds before completion.
Yeah, very narrow victory.
Yeah, and they grab a clock gyro from the smoking wreckage as evidence, and then they just walk away. They climb out of the basement and leave the thwarted apocalypse behind.
Just like that.
Why? Because Kiltak has tunnel vision. He does not care about the end of the universe. He cares about the address on that glass eye package.
It perfectly illustrates the psychology of the Avenger. The cosmic threat is irrelevant compared to the personal grievance. The macro-level apocalypse takes a backseat to the micro-level vendetta.
It is wild, but it seamlessly transitions us to their next destination. The address on the package leads them directly to 249 Market Street in the bustling shopping district of Braddock, Grunwalder's Antiques.
On the surface, a completely innocuous storefront blending in with the commerce of a busy city.
Right. They walk in, the bell rings, and a polite clerk named Lester tells them the owner is upstairs. They head up to the second floor, weaving through crowded displays of old armor and tapestries. And there he is. Grunwalder.
One-eyed man.
He looks like a 40-year-old man wearing scale armor. He has a cruel scar running down his face, and sitting right there in his eye socket is the yellow glass eye. Kiltak draws his weapon and immediately threatens to mount Grunwalder's head on a spike.
Grunwalder's reaction is very telling here.
He doesn't even flinch.
Yeah.
He doesn't draw a weapon. He simply speaks a word of magic and instantly paralyzes the entire party.
He freezes them completely in place. He strips them of their physical agency entirely, not to kill them, but simply to force them to listen. He demands an audience for his monologue.
And oh boy, what a monologue.
The contents of that speech are precision engineered to be utterly devastating to Kiltak.
He verbally dismantles Kiltak's entire childhood. Kiltak has spent his life believing his parents, Ragnar and Freya, were noble adventurers who were tragically struck down. Grunwalder looks at this paralyzed warrior and tells him the truth. They weren't heroes. They were petty thieves.
Just common burglars?
Yeah. They broke into Grunwalder's hoard and stole a sword called Oathkeeper, which Kiltak has carried his entire life, literally naming his quest for vengeance after it.
And Grunwalder knows exactly how to twist the knife. He casually informs Kiltak that Oathkeeper wasn't even a magical artifact. It was his lead valuable item. It was junk.
Junk.
He claims the glass paperweight sitting on his antique desk was worth more than the sword Kiltak's parents died for.
And Grunwalder explains that he tracked them down and slaughtered them, not because the sword was valuable, but out of sheer unadulterated pettiness.
And it gets darker?
Much darker. He admits that when Kiltak was a child during the attack, Grunwalder intentionally let the boy gash his eye. He let Kiltak escape. He has spent the last decade watching Kiltak grow up, specifically waiting for him to become a quote-unquote hero with a capital H, just so the eventual kill would be a proper challenge.
It is a staggering, almost incomprehensible display of arrogance.
I mean, here's where it gets really interesting, though. I have to push back on this villain's logic. If Grunwalder is so powerful that he can paralyze a room full of seasoned fighters with a single word, why on earth would he care so deeply about the theft of a junk sword?
Right, it seems contradictory.
Why hold a grudge against a literal child for over a decade? It's like a cruel chef letting a meal marinate for 10 years just to savor it more. Why not just snap his fingers, take the sword back the day it was stolen, and be done with it?
Well, to understand that, you have to look at the psychology of what Grunwalder actually is, which the party is about to discover. You're applying human logic to an ancient, immortal being. For a creature like Grunwalder, it has nothing to do with the material value of the stolen item. It is entirely about the audacity of the act, the absolute disrespect of lesser creatures daring to take what is his.
So he's hiding out as an antique dealer because he views all of human history as his personal property.
Precisely. Look at the psychological warfare he is employing here. Grunwalder didn't just want to kill Kiltak physically. If he wanted to do that, he could have slit his throat while he was paralyzed. By telling him this story, Grünwalder is attempting to destroy the heroic myth Kiltak had built around his parents.
He wants to break his spirit.
He wants to prove that Kiltak's core identity as an Avenger is based on a pathetic lie. He tells Kiltak he's just going to take the sword back and leave, forcing Kiltak to live with the profound humiliation of knowing his life's purpose was essentially a practical joke.
But the psychological warfare fails. Kiltak does not break. Fighting against the magical paralysis, Kiltak looks the man in the eye and promises again that he will put his head on a spike.
A bold move.
And Grünwalder, seemingly amused that the prey still has some fight left, drops the paralysis spell. He intends to just take the sword back. But when Kiltak threatens him, he draws his own massive greatsword and essentially says, "Let's dance."
Which initiates one of the most explosive climaxes in the source material.
Explosive is definitely the right word. Kiltak and the party's rogue, Virgil, are blindingly fast. The moment the spell drops, they rush Grünwalder. They strike with such brutal precision that they actually drive this immortal being to one knee.
An incredible feat for mere mortals.
For a split second, it looked like they might overwhelm him in the cramped antique shop. But then, Grünwalder stops playing human.
The illusion drops completely, and physics reasserts itself.
A tremendous, catastrophic explosion rips through the building. The antique shop is instantly annihilated. The party is thrown backward, ears ringing, finding themselves lying prone on the edge of a smoking crater 70 feet wide, right in the middle of Braddock's shopping district.
Just total devastation.
The surrounding buildings are shattered. Civilians are screaming, running for their lives like ants from a kicked anthill. And rising from the smoke in the center of this crater is Grünwalder's true form.
A gargantuan red dragon.
A monster the size of a building, missing its right eye, bearing the exact same cruel scar down its scaled face. It is pure cinematic chaos. I mean, it's like a kaiju movie breaking out in the middle of a historical drama.
That's exactly what it feels like.
The dragon sweeps its massive head, spraying napalm-like fire across the cobblestones, melting stone and glass. And then, projecting its voice over the roar of the flames, it gives its real villain speech.
And the historical context the dragon provides here is staggering. It doesn't just roar. It lists its atrocities over millennia to assert its absolute dominance over these mortals.
He boasts about rewriting history. He tells them he killed Marduk, the very first Gradscan king of Holland, and stole his crown. He personally destroyed the treasure fleet of Namkeg. He hunted down the 99 gods of the Caliphate. He burned the Arctic capital of Inkeri to ash just to rip an artifact called Lethe's Star from the ruins.
And we have to ask why he did these things. A dragon doesn't need a crown, and it certainly doesn't need Lethe's Star.
Right. What's the point?
Grünwalder isn't just killing for territory. He is systematically erasing human and divine achievement. By hoarding these specific historical artifacts, he is hoarding power. Disguising himself as an antique dealer allowed him to hide in plain sight, sitting on top of the world's cultural heritage, much like a traditional dragon sits on a pile of gold coins.
Wow.
He views entire civilizations as nothing more than additions to his collection.
And now he intends to add Kiltak to that collection. The combat that follows requires the party to get incredibly creative just to survive. The dragon is continuously bathing the street in fire and flapping its enormous wings to create hurricane-force gusts that physically throw the party backward.
They cannot fight a gargantuan creature toe-to-toe. They have to turn the dragon into a terrain feature. They have to fight on him.
Exactly. So Victor Ashborn taps into his druidic magic, casting a jump spell that allows Kiltak to leap incredible distances, clearing of the flames to reach the dragon's legs. Elgis, the fire, pushes his body beyond normal limits, using an action surge for a blinding burst of adrenaline.
A very tactical use of skills.
He ties a thick rope to a javelin, hurls it with devastating force right into the dragon's thick neck scales, and then physically climbs up the rope through the smoke. Meanwhile, Hayden, the warlock, simply steps into the shadows on the ground and teleports directly onto the dragon's back.
It is a masterclass in asymmetrical warfare. But the defining moment of the battle, and really of the entire narrative arc, happens on the ground.
When the antique shop exploded, human Grünwalder dropped his greatsword. Victor notices it lying in the rubble near Kiltak. Now remember, Grünwalder spent his entire monologue mocking Kiltak's sword, Oathkeeper, calling it worthless junk. So Kiltak makes a split-second choice. He unclips his father's sword, Oathkeeper, letting it fall into the dirt, and he bends down and picks up Grünwalder's own stolen weapon. So tell me, what does this poetic justice mean here?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the irony is profound. The sources reveal that this isn't just a large sword. This weapon hums with latent mythic magic. It is the legendary +2 greatsword of Gradska, a weapon Grünwalder stole millennia ago when he killed a demigod warlord.
There is such a brutal poetry here. Kiltak dropping Oathkeeper represents him finally letting go of the false, idealized myth of his parents.
Exactly. He is weaponizing Grünwalder's own arrogance against him. By taking up Gradska's sword, Kiltak transitions from a boy seeking revenge for petty thieves into a true mythic hero.
Armed with a god-killing sword, Kiltak uses the magic leap to launch himself onto the dragon. Elgis grabs the rope attached to the javelin and literally swings Kiltak through the air right into the dragon's face.
An incredible maneuver.
Using Grodzka's stolen blade, Kiltak drives the weapon deep into the dragon's remaining eye.
The blinding strike is catastrophic. The dragon frenzies, thrashing wildly to shake them off, bleeding immense amounts of magic and life force.
But they hold on, and Kiltak delivers the final lethal blow. The ancient terror finally succumbs, crashing dead into its own smoking crater.
It is incredible. Kiltak literally and narratively levels up. He slays an ancient god-killing terror. He earns that title of hero with a capital H that Grünwalder so mockingly prepared him for.
He proves that while his origins may have been a lie, his capabilities are entirely real. What a journey. For you listening, think about the ground we covered today.
It's a lot.
In the span of just a few city blocks, this party went from winding up creepy mechanical spiders in a cluttered shop, to thwarting a time-ending industrial clock god in a basement, to leveling a city block in order to slay an ancient, shape-shifting red dragon.
It serves as a powerful reminder of how interconnected the layers of this world truly are.
It really does. It reminds you that sometimes, pulling on the absolute smallest thread like, following a mundane mail delivery tip about a yellow glass ICANN unravels centuries of hidden history, lies, and magic.
And while the immediate threat of Grünwalder is neutralized, it leaves you with one final, deeply unsettling question to mull over.
Oh.
In his arrogance, Grünwalder freely admitted that he spent millennia hoarding unimaginably powerful artifacts. Lethe's Star, the crown of King Marduk, the wealth of entire naval fleets.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That doesn't just disappear.
Exactly. Now that he lies dead in a 70-foot smoking crater in the middle of Braddock, his protections are gone. His hoard is vulnerable, which begs the question, who or what is going to come looking to claim the hoard of a god killer?
I have a feeling the line is going to be out the door and it's not going to be friendly.
Until
next time, keep your eyes open.